Hello, I'm Mark Ovenden on Vectis Radio FM 104.6. In this hour, we have all your usual music and news and sport, but you know how we'd love to dish up some knowledge on a Friday evening. And tonight, we are celebrating a hugely significant event in transportation history. We are chatting Art, Transport, Communications and History. That's a C-A-T-C-H. I call it the Catchcast. And we're hoping to get you as fascinated by our geeky old subjects as myself and the wonderful guests. In this edition, we find out about something called the Greatest Gathering of Railway Engines. Why is Britain alive with railway history events this year? How can you take part right here on the Isle of Wight? And how can you get involved online? Today we are most honoured to be joined by Ben Goodwin, who's a communications director at Alstom. Welcome to the Catchcast, sir.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Ben, we're absolutely thrilled for you to join us, and we're definitely going to dive deep into the Railway 200 events you've been pretty much at the centre of. But I wonder if we can start taking you back a bit and ask how you yourself got interested in transport.
I am a train spotter, a rail fan, whatever you want to call it, through and through. My younger brother was born, and I think I was just getting in the way of my parents, particularly my mum at the time, who was caring for my baby brother. And she just said to my dad, take him out of the house, go somewhere, you know, let him run off some energy and come back. And we grew up in a suburb of York, in Acombe, and he took me to Holgate Bridge. And I stood over Holgate Bridge, and for those of you who know York, Holgate Bridge overlooks the entrance to York Station coming from the south. And yeah, I was hooked. And then I think every night for about 5 years, I would beg and plead with my dad that he'd take me down to see the train. And I gave them all, I mean, obviously they all have class numbers as trains do, but I gave them all bizarre names. Like, my dad always reminds me that I called one of them a Ginza. I don't know what that is. But I gave them all these kind of like nicknames. And yeah, I mean, that was my gateway into a lifelong passion. And now somehow I've made a career out of railways as well, which is, it's just a dream come true.
Well, lucky man. And I understand that one of your first jobs even was at the incredible Railway Museum in York.
Well, yes. And actually my first job, well, apart from a paper round that I had, but my first job, I did some work experience at York Model Railway, which is now the pub at York train station. And I used to fix the model trains on a weekend. And then a friend of a family friend, she was working at the National Railway Museum. And I mean, I'm going back, what, 2002, 2003. And they were paying £5.50 an hour to look after cars in the car park. So of course I was like, I mean, that was for me, it was like, you know, what could I do with that in our price or Woolworths? So I said goodbye to the 00 and I went to the car park, not quite standard gauge, and yeah, worked there. And then I remember it was a couple of days and it just poured it down with rain, and I was like, no, I'm not having this. So I marched into the museum and I said, I want to be with the trains, I love trains, like, take me on. And they did. They took me on. And then in the school holidays I ran the children's activity, and we did make and take activities, dressing up, and I even took part in a world record attempt to build the world's longest origami train.
Wow.
That was when we got donated the bullet train from Japanese Railways to go on display in the museum. So yeah, amazing time there. And I'm still in touch with quite a lot of people there. I still have an affinity to it. I go back to York a lot, and it's always a special place. And I was just thrilled that they were involved in the greatest gathering that I've organised as well. So there was a really nice synergy there.
And we'll definitely come on to the Greatest Gathering in a bit, but I'm still fascinated in your early life, because a bit like me, actually, started being interested in trains when you were a kid, but then you kind of went off the rails a bit into the wonderful world of media. I believe you started working for BBC Radio 2, no less.
My undergraduate was history at the University of Birmingham, and I started volunteering, and then I got paid work at the BBC in Birmingham. And at the time, they'd just moved from Pebble Mill to the mailbox, and a lot of the Radio 2 output came from the centre of Birmingham. So I worked with Janice Long, Alice Lester, you know, some incredible stalwarts of the airwaves. And essentially I started off as a broadcast assistant and then kind of worked my way through. And then I went and did my postgraduate as a broadcast journalist. That's my part of my career was in journalism, and carried on. And I did freelance for Five Live, and then went and worked for various commercial commercial stations. But yeah, it was fantastic. And, you know, somebody who loves their music, and Janice Long, the stories she had from the people that she'd met, and even the people that we met, guests that came in. I remember spending the evening with the Sugar Babes, Gary Newman, you know, so many fantastic people. It was just a real exciting time to be in Birmingham and work on that show.
Wow. And then you spent several years after that, I believe, working with things like museums and universities. And finally, you ended up back with railways working for HS2. Is that right?
Yeah. So it's amazing, you know, when you think of your career like this, it's amazing the kind of twists and turns that it takes you. But essentially, I was working for a group of radio stations. And during the recession, it was a case of last in, first out. And I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I remember going to the job centre and being like, well, you know, what do I do? Luckily, I got a fantastic job working in marketing at the Herbert Museum in Coventry. And then from there, I kind of stayed within museums, and I went to the Barber Institute at the University of Birmingham, and then stayed in higher education after that, and sort of did comms roles at the University of Birmingham and Birmingham City University, which incidentally was the university that I did my undergraduate at and my postgraduate. So it's kind of like I'd already gone full circle sort of by the time I was in my late 20s. But yeah, so I was based in Birmingham, living in Birmingham, and when they moved the headquarters for HS2 to Birmingham, I was like a dog with a bone. I had to be part of that project. Mm. Even though I'd worked in journalism and such like, I was still passionately into trains. It was still very much part of my life. And I thought, if I'm going to change sectors, I'm going to work for rail. So yeah, I applied for the job and got it. And I worked there for 5 years. It was a character building project to be on. I had a fantastic time and met some incredible people and just absolutely loved it. And just hope that it all gets built. I mean, that's my hope.
Yeah, get it built.
I'm from the north, as I say, so you know, I want it to go all the way up to both sides of the north. You know, let's build the full Y network. But it was the capacity thing for me, and now going regularly to London on the train from the Midlands, we really need more capacity. So that's what I believed in, and I still very much believe in that with HS2.
Mm, brilliant project. Hope it does eventually happen. And then after that, I think, is when you arrived at Alstom, is that correct?
Yeah, so the job came up for Director of Communications for UK and Ireland, and I looked at the job description, and it was like 37 sites, 6,000 employees. I was like, whoa, this job is not going to come up again anytime soon. So I was very happy at HS2. I loved the project, as I said, and had a great team there. But I thought, do you know what? This is not going to come up again. So yeah, I threw my hat in the ring, and somebody thought that I was a good fit for the company. And here I am 2 years later. So really in the thick of it. And for people who are unaware of Alstom, we were primarily known in the UK as a train manufacturer. We have the largest railway factory in the world outside of China, here in Derby, where I'm sat right now, 90-acre site. But then we have 36 other sites across the country, which are primarily geared up for servicing and maintaining. So we built historically about half the UK fleet, and we maintain around about 60% of the trains that run in the UK. So any train that you get on, it will have been cleaned, maintained, fixed, you know, by us at some point. And we also do signalling as well. You say signalling when it sounds like, you know, pulling levers and things like that, but it's incredibly digital these days. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people sat in giant server rooms. So yeah, it's a fantastic company. We build the TGV in France. That's kind of our sort of signature product, if you like, known around the world. But we will be building the HS2 trains in a joint venture with Hitachi as well. So we will be building high-speed trains for the UK as well.
Ben, can you give us a quick overview of what the Railway 200 events taking place across Britain are kind of all about, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So Railway 200, as you say, is a celebration of 200 years of the modern railway. And what that means is we are using the first ever steam locomotive to carry passengers on a public railway. That's kind of seen as the start of the modern railway. And that happened on the Stockton and Darlington Railway, hauled by locomotion number one in September 1825. So it's a momentous occasion of not just of British significance, but of global significance. You know, let's not forget, we gave the railways to the world. But I think Railway 200 is more than just looking back, because, you know, there is a nostalgia of the railways, and people talk about the golden age. You know, was it the 30s? People would argue it's still yet to come. But I think it's important that we recognise the railways today and how important they are, and not just in terms of moving people, but also freight. People don't realise that the majority of our supermarket shopping will travel up and down the country by train. So it's incredibly important to our lives and the economy. But also, I think what's great about Railway 200 is there's an element of it that it is looking to the future as well. Railway 200 is a partnership-led initiative. It's kind of been spearheaded by the government and Network Rail and the Great British Railways Transition Team, but it's very much about the whole industry coming together. And I think, as well as looking back, the industry is also looking to the future. And we talked about HS2, but there's so many other fantastic innovations and opportunities. And I think that's really important as well, because the railways are an incredible place to work, but I think historically it's maybe not done the best in terms of promoting that way of work, or people may think it's dirty and it's oily, and it can be in parts, you know, there's no getting around that, but it's a very clean, sustainable industry. You know, I was talking about the signalling arm that Alstom has here in the UK. It's incredibly digital. We need computer programmers. We don't need people who can mend and fix things. We need people who have got exceptional digital skills. So I think that's what's been really good about Railway 200, is we can shine a spotlight on the industry, on the railway family, and say, actually, this is a great place for you to develop a long lasting and rewarding career as well.
Nice one. Looking to the future as well as the past. Ben, you've nicely set the scene for us with what Railway 200 is. Can you muse with me about that first passenger train journey back in 1825? Do we have any idea if the participants knew just how, I don't know, revolutionary trains would become, not just for the region, but the whole world?
I think people had an inkling back then that what they were taking part in was something of significance. But I think with any new technology, there's always the doubters, and there's always, you know, oh, it's a flash in the pan, it'll never work. But I think the thing with the railways is how quickly it spread. And don't forget, you know, the Stockton-Darlington Railway was built primarily to move goods around the northeast. You know, it carried passengers on that opening day, but that wasn't its primary use. What the S&DR signifies is that kind of methodic approach to building railways. This was the first planned public railway. It was about connecting places that had never been connected before. This wasn't just about servicing a small factory somewhere. This was about linking large parts of the country. And then, of course, very soon afterwards, we had the first intercity railway, which was obviously the Liverpool to Manchester railway. And then there's some fantastic visual moving maps online where you can see just how quickly things spread, and then quickly spread around the world. You know, Europe, and then we exported initially lots of them to the USA, to South America, before they established their own capabilities of producing steam locomotives and rolling stock. So I think while there may have been doubters about this, certainly it was something that spread incredibly quickly.
When I was doing some research, I found something from 1822, so before Stockton and Darlington, from a chap called Thomas Gray, where he envisaged an iron railway linking Britain's major cities. It was quite prophetic, wasn't it, really? Because that's kind of exactly what happened in the years following the Stockton and Darlington and Liverpool and Manchester.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And he clearly had the foresight that perhaps other contemporaries didn't. And don't forget, you know, when this was all starting, everybody thought that the canals were the king. Yes, we had roads, but not as roads as we imagine them today. And things we really take for granted. I mean, Greenwich Mean Time, they had different time zones across the UK. The railways, because of the speed of them, meant that we had to standardise time. It meant that you could catch fish in Grimsby and it could be served inland by the tea time. And there's lots of different industries and different facets of modern life that you look into it, and it was the railways that revolutionised it. Newspapers, another example. Rhubarb. There was a specific train that would take the rhubarb from Yorkshire down to London. So I think in today's world, you know, we most of us who have access to a car, we get in the car and off we go. But back then, this idea of being able to travel, and travel fast as well, you know, and obviously that locomotion number one, I think, was 10, 20 miles an hour. It wasn't fast by today's term. But back then, that would have been incredibly fast. We take for granted that we have, you know, mass mobility, but the railways really enabled that and democratized it as well, made it affordable to the masses.
Well, because people just didn't move out of their local town or village, did they? They just effectively walked everywhere or got on a horse, maybe. But after the railways, it just sped up so quickly.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we've also got things like sporting events as well. And people never travelled from one end of the country to the other to watch a football match until the invention of the railways.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, Manchester United Football Club, that was born out of a railway manufacturer up in Manchester. So yeah, the railways have a lot to answer for. My partner's Argentinian, and the spread of football in Argentina is down to British railway workers going over to help the Argentines build the first railway networks, and then they would set up football teams around. So he's from Rosario, and one of the local teams is called Central, and they were helping to build the Central Railway, you know. So the railways really do have these intrinsic links to every part of our society. Whether you use a train or not, whether you've ever been on a train, we are intrinsically linked to the railways. And I think there's something really, really beautiful about that.
I'm glad you picked up on Argentina, because when I was doing one of my books, I remember seeing a satellite photograph of the world at night. And then there were all these long, thin settlements lit up. And when you overlay where those settlements are, particularly inland in those big continents like South America, North America, Centre of Asia, they basically correspond to where the railways were built.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. And what's great now is you're seeing that, we're kind of seeing that new derogation of that, if you like, you know, with how quickly railways have been built in all of the parts of the world, not just here in the UK, but, you know, I've been lucky enough to visit China and South Korea, and just seeing how important they are to them. And let's not forget even the USA, who everybody assumes, oh, car is king. They're building a high-speed rail network in California. So what's reassuring is that, yes, we've got this brilliant history, but even after 200 years, steel on steel is still the most efficient way of moving large amounts of people and things in bulk. And I think there's something real, again, to me, it's just kind of magical. You know, we were talking before about everything coming full circle, but, you know, we're here celebrating Railway 200. I don't see why people after us won't be celebrating Railway 300, 400, 500. Mm-hmm. I think there will always be a place for the railways in society.
So we're quite rightly flying the flag for railways this year, and you've just been involved in an event whose name summed it up. Do please tell us what you've been doing, Ben.
Yes, so somehow I've managed to organise the world's largest ever gathering of modern and historic trains, and it was called The Greatest Gathering. It was held at Alstom's Derby factory between the 1st and 3rd of August.
It must have been a logistical nightmare to bring all those engines and people from all over the country. Can you let us in on a few of the stories you had preparing the event?
Yes, well, essentially about a year ago, we were contacted by Gus Dunster, who's Severn Valley Railway's managing director, and a gentleman called James Dobson from Avanti West Coast, the operator who operate the express trains up the West Coast Main Line. And they'd done a similar event in Crewe several years ago and were keen to do something for a Railway 200. They knew we had the space. We're currently between orders, as in orders of building new trains. So I managed to, well, I don't ever think I asked permission for it. I think I just went ahead and said, yeah, yeah, we'll do it, we'll work with you. And I still think I'm asking for permission now. But going back to my earlier career that we talked about before at the National Railway Museum, they held something similar in 2012 called Railfest. Now, Railfest had 50 locomotives, and they called it Britain's biggest rail celebration. Mm. So, of course, I said, if we're going to do it, we need 51, and then we can legitimately call it Britain's biggest rail celebration. Fast forward almost a year later, and we somehow ended up with 140 items of rolling stock on our site. Now, luckily, the site is 90 acres. It's huge. It's the largest railway factory in the world outside of China, so we could definitely accommodate it. But you're right, the logistical challenge was pretty intense. Luckily, Gus and James, that was their wheelhouse, and they liaised with all the operators and they made it happen. Essentially, about 25% of those came by road, which is ironic considering that it's a rail event and we are connected to the national network. But some of these old iron beasts, shall we say, need a bit of a helping hand. So they came by road. And then the majority of the rolling stock came in large convoys. So, I mean, we had unprecedented convoys of sort of four steam engines hauling like six carriages coming onto site, which, you know, was an event in itself. And that's how we did it. And then once they were on site, Gus and James and their sort of small team worked with our movements team, who I have to say, the movements team here at Litchurch Lane were incredible. I mean, they're used to moving trains around site because that's what they do. But they're used to moving modern trains that we built, you know, for the modern network. And I think it was a bit of a challenge because they had to learn all different couplings for all these different locomotives and engines and carriages. But they did an incredible job. And yeah, it was basically then a giant Tetris game, if you like. like getting everything into place, because we tried to display them thematically. So high speed, anything that was made in Derby was in one place, the electric locomotives were in one place. And bless them, we had a media launch on the Thursday night and everyone had a great time, but I was like, oh, that shouldn't be there, that shouldn't be there. And they were up until the very, very small hours of the Friday morning before we opened to the public. And I remember coming onto site at 5 a.m. There was people already queuing to get into the event at 5 a.m.
Wow.
I did say it to him, I said, you know, we're not open till 10. He said, oh no, it's fine, it's fine. But he was first in, bless him.
And I hope you gave him a nice warming cup of tea, poor chap.
I think he was well looked after, yeah. Luckily, we held it in the summer as well, so it wasn't too cold. But yeah, so I remember walking around the corner and I saw that lineup, and we had the Eurostar, the Pride Pendolino, the Class 91 in the National Railway Museum livery, and an Intercity 125, which was designed here in Derby. The carriages were built here. And I just cried because they'd just done such an incredible job. So it was just magical, you know, that coming together of people from different parts of the industry. And I think that's how we made it happen. You know, yes, there was a tiny team of us working on this alongside our full-time jobs, but I think the industry wanted it to happen. We had the space. Yes, our name was above the door, but we gave people that space and we were able to make it happen just by the sheer amount of room that we had. And I think everybody else was like, yes, we're not going to do this again for at least another 50 years. We had one person, and I'm not going to name any names, but they turned up with their locomotive at the factory gates, literally on the back of a lorry, and said, we want our locomotive on display. And we did a few checks to make sure that they were legitimate. And yes, it proudly went on display as part of the event. So, you know, everybody from individual owners right up to the biggest train operators in the country, everybody in the industry was involved.
I can feel from the way you speak that the emotion of seeing all of those wonderful vehicles together must have been really quite moving.
Yeah, it was breathtaking because, as I say, all we wanted was 51. And then to get 140. And our workshops are massive. We're talking hangar size workshops, enough to fit a 200 metre Elizabeth line train in. So we filled one workshop with STEM activity. So that's science, technology, engineering and math. So all interactive activities to sort of really inspire the next generation. So there was everything in there from, you know, how to design an aerodynamic train to welding demonstrations to, you know, just colouring in activities for the little ones. Then we had a whole workshop that was full of what we call the railway family. So anybody who'd supported the event was encouraged to bring a stand along, showcase the jobs that they had on offer, what they did, you know, really to explain to people all the different facets of the industry. Then we had a history and heritage zone, you know, with all the local heritage associations. We had a marketplace where you could buy items that were related to the railway. And then we had a giant hall that was full of model trains as well. So there was festivals within festivals, and it was just... it just kept growing and growing and growing. And I guess I was at the helm of it and I was organising it and I knew how big it was getting. But I think you just take it all within your stride when you're seeing it day to day. But I remember walking onto that site on the first day and I was like, this is incredible. If I wasn't here working it, I would want to be here as a visitor. I was just blessed that we got such a great reaction. The reason why it worked is that often any kind of events like this, not just in transport, but they can be quite segregated. You have like the industry events, then you have like the volunteer events, and then you have like the family events. But this was all together. So basically, it was anybody that was coming to this event and they were united by one thing. They love railways. But from all different walks of life, all different backgrounds, it was an incredibly diverse event as well, which I was really, really proud of. So I think that was the thing for me. Yes, it was great having 140 trains on site and, you know, world record breaking and all that. But for me, it was the people that it brought together. And that's something that I'll cherish for the rest of my life.
Beautiful. I'm kicking myself I wasn't able to come. I really am. But for those of us who couldn't get to Derby, shame on us. Are there any events coming up that we can take part in that are still to arrive?
Oh, absolutely. And the beauty of Railway 200 is there is stuff happening across the breadth of Great Britain, which is just amazing. I guess the signature thing to look out for is the exhibition train that Railway 200 have arranged. So this is two Class 66 locomotives hauling, I think it's four or five Mark III carriages that were built here at Litchurch Lane, and they've been modified, and it's essentially an exhibition on wheels. I've never seen anything like it before, and it's going up and down the country the rest of this year and part of next year as well. And it's, you know, I don't want to say coming to a train station near you, but I think it probably will be. So I would recommend that people go and look on the Railway 200 website and see where Inspiration, it's called, is the exhibition train, because it's fantastic. I mean, you've got a whole carriage that's dedicated to history, you know, railway furs. I mean, fantastic things in there. Like, did you know that the first registered railway employee was female?
Wow.
I'm not going to say any more than that. You need to go to the carriage to find out exactly what they did. But then you've got another carriage that it's about the railway today and all the, you know, the different facets that we were talking about before, how it's becoming more digital, how it's safe, how we keep the trains running. And then you've got a fantastic interactive experience that's, again, been designed in partnership with the National Railway Museum. And the stuff in there is just incredible. And if you weren't interested in railways, just by trying to build a bridge or you build a virtual train track and things like that, it's just, you know, there's something there for everybody. So I definitely say get involved in that. And then, of course, the big anniversary is in September. So it was when Locomotion No. 1 first rode on the rails on that first journey. So there's a lot of events happening in the northeast of England where that happened. Locomotion No. 1 was built in Newcastle by Robert Stephenson and Company. And there's a great Alstom link there because that company, Robert Stephenson Company, became part of Alstom Estate in 1989. So that was another reason why we wanted to do something special for Railway 200, because we have a duty, a responsibility. We're custodians of that legacy. So I think it was really important for us that we did this. But yeah, so there's loads of events going on. So just go on their website and you'll probably get lost for about 3 hours and then not just, you know, it's like going on to Netflix. It's like, well, what should we watch? There's so much stuff happening. You'll be spoiled for choice. It's a really exciting, if you're into railways, or even if you're not into railways, because as I say, we talked about the social history before. There's always an inroad where you can find a way to get into the interest that will align with what you're into.
Well, this has been a fascinating whistle-stop tour of Railway 200 and the amazing-sounding Greatest Gathering. Our huge thanks to Ben Goodwin of Awesome for joining us on the Catchcast. Thanks, Ben.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
You can find out more on the website railway200.co.uk. Do not miss the Steam Fair event at the Isle of Wight Steam Railway, which is part of this. That's taking place tomorrow. Next week's Catchcast is not to be missed. We are doing more chatting art, transport, communications and history. Join us then.